Welcome to Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, a podcast brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. TIPQC exists to improve health outcomes for mothers and infants in Tennessee through our quality collaborative that will identify opportunities to optimize maternal and infant outcomes across our state and is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. The Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast is designed for medical professionals and for patients and families across the state. We will focus on all aspects of the perinatal period with special attention to reducing our maternal mortality rate. This podcast is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health.
We're back this week on this episode's podcast, the Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, to continue our discussion with Dr. Klein about how to take care of the tiniest babies that we see in the neonatal intensive care unit. So let me pick up where we were last week, Jonathan. So we had this baby. We intubated this baby, this tiny baby. We're talking 22, 23, 24 weeks. We got this baby intubated within the first 30 seconds in the delivery room. We did minimal PEEP exposure. We let the baby have a higher oxygen requirement until we got the baby back into the neonatal intensive care unit. We gave a dose of surfactant, and now I've got to figure out what to do next. So what do you do in Iowa? What's the Iowa approach with these babies?
I'm going to just back up a tiny bit, and I want to, again, focus on one other thing in the delivery room, which is during the resuscitation, one of the questions is, what FiO2 should be in your analyzer? And we know that 30%, unfortunately, that's the current NRP recommendation for premature babies, again, is designed for babies that have a VLI, and lots of alveolar sacs at 32 weeks and beyond, but it really was never designed for babies with a canalicular stage. And you also have much greater depth of mesenchyme for the oxygen to diffuse across, so you need a higher gradient. So we've just stumbled upon basically using 50% as our baseline to resuscitate with, and we wean from there. And we know from some other studies, there was a randomized controlled trial, didn't include 22-weekers, but under 28 weeks, if they started with 100% oxygen versus room air for babies born less than 28 weeks, the mortality was 4 times higher starting with room air versus 100% oxygen. So we know this population, this subgroup under 28 weeks, certainly under 24 weeks, is going to need a higher oxygen gradient to be able to oxygenate right from the beginning. We also know from a paper from those same authors that they showed if you don't reach SATs in the 80s by 5 minutes of life, which is the recommendation from NRP, that when they followed up on those babies at age 2, they had a higher incidence of neurodevelopmental disability by not reaching SATs in the 80s by 5 minutes of life. So we want to make that a priority. Now, there is an RCT that's ongoing out west where they're looking at starting with 100% oxygen for a minute and then rapidly weaning. I think once the results of that are out, we'll have more defined data for this type of population. So that's one of the things. The worst thing is to be struggling trying to get the pulmonary vascular, you have to ventilate them. So obviously, we have to use enough peak inspiratory pressure, regardless of the device, to move the chest wall, lower the CO2, reduce pulmonary vascular resistance, and get that blood going into the lungs and therefore going into the left atrium, left ventricle. So I don't want to imply, yes, we try to avoid hyperinflation with that PEEP of 5 to 6, now 5, but we want to make sure the chest wall is moving and understanding the thickness of the mesenchyme at that gestation, you've got to have that gradient to get that oxygen in. Okay, so we get to the NICU. We make sure with these tiny babies, you can't use the weight in kilos plus 6 centimeters. You've got to use other data, which is usually ends up being 5.5 to 6 centimeters. And there are papers on that. And we want to get an x-ray so you don't give all the surfactant to one lung, which makes a challenge. So what we do is we're very cognizant of the danger of volute trauma. There is so much literature on volute trauma. So we want to use first intention high frequency. And the device that we use, the JET, allows us to use, instead of tidal volumes of 5 mLs per kilo, we're talking about tidal volumes that tend to be less than 1 mL per kilo. So the whole focus is not to get overdistended, impede preload, impede cardiac output, impede cerebral blood flow, and we want to minimize the volute trauma and let the surfactant do our lung recruitment rather than a large amount of PEEP. Now, we feel that there was good work from Dr. Martin Kessler back in the 90s showing when you use the jet appropriately, you can reduce the incidence of BPD in half, is what he showed in that RCT. Babies, you know, we did have surfactant in the 90s. People may not believe that, but we did. And we, many of us were involved in RCTs in the late 80s, and you always knew who got the surfactant. Wasn't hard. So that combination is important. And so in that population, you got surfactant, started on first intention jet, had a approach that minimized low CO2, so they didn't suffer from hypocapnia. They had good outcomes. Now, there was another study done roughly at the same time that had problems with extreme hypocarbia, CO2 as low as 17. And that study, even though it was an RCT, that unfortunately, because they had trouble managing CO2s optimally, that led to increased neurologic injury from IVH and PVL, which of course is expected with low CO2 and ischemia reperfusion injury. So it's important with the first intention high frequency to have a good management strategy and know how to use it correctly, because it's so effective at ventilating, you can end up having problems with hypocarbia. Hmm. Now, one of the most interesting things that people have always complained about was, well, that study was done in the middle, in the 90s, and we have better conventional ventilators. Well, even though you have better conventional ventilators, you still are limited to 5 mLs per kilo. And sometimes the danger people make with certain conventional ventilators is they keep turning the pressure limit up to achieve that tidal volume, and they soon reach pressures in the middle 20s, which were shown in the 80s to be strongly associated with pulmonary interstitial emphysema, which causes a lot of death in this population. So very recently, Brigham and Women's Hospital, which is in the division of Harvard, published a paper that they were a volume targeted, guaranteed conventional ventilator placed the standard 5 per kilo. And they started introducing the jet using the same management styles strategies we have proliferated since the early 2000s. And they adapted sort of the Iowa approach. And they went and looked at the populations that they managed with volume guaranteed conventional ventilation compared to high frequency jet ventilation. And and what they found was it made the difference once again in the most premature population. So older than 26 weeks, it didn't make any difference. The outcomes are the same, but less than or equal to 26 weeks, which obviously is 22, 23, 24, they had incredibly an 80%, almost an 80% reduction in death or severe IVH using a first intention high frequency jet approach. So I was very excited to see in their methodology that they called out Iowa as a center that they had consulted with when they wanted to introduce a new strategy of ventilation in this population.
So for our audience too, can you define, when you talk about the CO2s, what range are you targeting here?
We're really targeting 45 to 55. And especially in a 22-weeker, you have to really think that it can take them 3 days, 7 days, 10 days to kind of transition, especially that first 3 days. They're very sensitive to the inability to auto-regulate cerebral blood flow. So we're kind of keeping it 40s and low 50s, not really tolerating high 50s and certainly not tolerating over 60, because we know the higher the CO2, the higher the cerebral blood flow. And it's okay to be, you know, in the old days where we're just using conventional, and we were very fixated about actually even 50 to 65 because we were so worried about lung injury. But now, if you're not using, you know, these tidal volumes of 5 to 6 per kilo, but you're using 1 per kilo, that's not going to occur unless you're hyperinflated. And so we feel very comfortable if we're on low settings and the CO2s in the low 40s, that's okay. We know the trouble with PVL usually starts to occur when you're spending time below 35. Well, so it's sort of this balance that we know, yes, we could have less lung injury if we did very aggressive permissive hypercarbia, but we're going to have more impact on the cerebral blood flow. And there's great work from many other people showing the higher that CO2, the greater the risk of IVH. In fact, even the lower the CO2 for a prolonged period of time, the ischemia reperfusion also leading to IVH. So over my, let's say, 40 years, you know, I went from very aggressive pulmonary protection, saying, okay, 50 to 65 right away, to having a better understanding as the literature showed more the bad effects of tolerating high CO2 in that first 72 hours. We certainly will shift the CO2s if we're starting to see lung injury and there's no IVH issues and we're more now 7 days, we might go, think about 50 to 65, but in the first week, we never go under above 60. Hyperglycemia, and I consider hyperglycemia greater than 150, that it's going to impact cerebral blood flow. The higher the glucose above a threshold level, you're going to decrease cerebral blood flow. And people don't think about this. A lot of people only think about hyperglycemia as when it reaches a renal threshold and have osmotic diuresis occurring at 180, 200, 220. They tolerate these higher glucose levels. And we don't tolerate those. We've shown association between that and ROP. And, you know, and when I kind of look at why is our NDI so low, I think it's because we try not to inhibit cerebral blood flow by having too little or too much. So I think it's important not to allow these babies to get hyperglycemic, and because that glucose is not being utilized. So as long as we keep our glucose in that 50 to 150 range, it's being utilized. But if we go above 150, that's just glucose that is going to end up causing harm. So to do that and also follow CO2 closely, the one time in this baby's life to get a lot of labs and not worry if you have to give a transfusion or two is that first 72 hours, maybe 96, to protect the brain. So we're going to follow glucose closely. We're going to follow CO2 closely. We're actually going to follow sodium closely because we don't want to allow that baby to develop AKI. Even if you use 100% humidity, many centers don't start on enough fluids and they rapidly have sodiums in the 160s and they get AKI. We don't use as much humidity. We just use ambient humidity as many places, which is unusual, but that allows us to give good nutrition. We never have to restrict our TPN so we can maximize protein intake and phosphorus intake, but we will limit the glucose so we don't get hyperglycemic. So many times our GIR might run initially 2 to 4 milligrams per kilogram per minute versus 4 to 5. So we don't have that hyperglycemia impacting the brain. The other thing is I'm a strong supporter of kangaroo care, but during the 120 days that baby's in, I want that kangaroo care not in the first 14 days, but the next 106 days. And that's what we need to be focused on that. The first 7 days, we basically want to protect that brain and not have these movements of the excessive movements of the baby other than positioning very gently in midline endotracheal tube. Then parents will hold midline. And then at day 14, we feel very comfortable. Everything should be auto-regulating now and doing kangaroo care. If you focus only on kangaroo care and not look at the baseline developmental state of the cerebral blood flow in that baby, you could be inadvertently causing harm. And that's just not fair to that family. So we want them to put their effort in kangarooing as much as possible once we get through that first 14 days and not subject that baby to these extreme stressors that they cannot auto-regulate for. So I think these are the things, and we want to get enough labs in that first high-risk period of time. And then as time goes by, let's cut the labs way back. And we want to minimize stress by kangaroo care, which I love, in the first 14 days. But then I want to do as much as possible. So we kangaroo on jets. Many of these babies will stay on jets 6 weeks, 7 weeks, 8 weeks. We'll kangaroo on the jet all the time. We do 24/7 if the mom doesn't have other children to care for.
Excellent. As we wrap up, any other pointers that you would, or words of wisdom that you would leave us with?
So I guess that the main thing, these babies are at high risk also of dying from infection. And this is not the population, again, I'm a heretic, that a 22-weeker is very immune suppressed. So this is not the population to be practicing antibiotic stewardship on. They're not a term baby who should get a 24-hour rule out. These babies, at baseline, we know at least 30% of chorioamnionitis, and using pathology, one of our new faculty has shown 70% have chorioamnionitis in the placenta on histology. So you can't do a 24-hour rule out in a 22-weeker. For us, our baseline course of antibiotics might be 7 to 10 days as we evaluate left shifts and how the baby's responding to therapies and other indices, inflammation. And there are a lot of centers that they tell me, well, they're 22-weekers, all die between day 5 and 7. And I say, when do you stop your antibiotics? When the blood culture is negative after a couple days. And the problem is many of these mothers are on latency antibiotics, which is one of the things, I know we didn't talk as much about what the obstetricians do, but our obstetricians will use latency antibiotics. We also don't do C-sections in this population until 23 0/7. So one of the things that we do is steroids start at 21 and 5, and fetal monitoring, electronic fetal monitoring doesn't occur to 23 0. And that's to balance out the risk to the mom as to the baby. So obstetrical job is incredibly hard with these two patient population. And we and our OBs are very comfortable not starting electronic fetal monitoring until 23 0.
Good. Man, that's a wealth of wisdom right there that we have gotten to glean from me over these past two podcasts. Greatly appreciate your time, but I've got one final question for you. And this is my favorite question to ask everybody. Let's suppose somebody gave you a gigantic billboard somewhere and you could put anything you wanted to on this billboard. This could be a quote that means something to you. It just could just be some words of wisdom. It could be something specific to what we have talked about. Something that you live your life by, anything at all, what would you say on that billboard? It's to recognize that the greatest error is not to have tried and failed, but that in trying, we did not give it our best effort. And that's attributed to Gene Kranz, the NASA flight director of Apollo missions.
Right. So I feel that represents the way we approach this population at Iowa, that you just don't go through the motions. If you're really going to care for babies before under 24 weeks, everyone has to be on board and take this very seriously. And it's so much harder than caring for a 28-weeker that it's very easy for people to say, well, this baby's extremely premature and there's nothing we can do. And that's just not true. You can do a lot if you take it seriously and with the right management strategies. I guess the other quote that I'll say from myself is when people start describing a problem, I always say, hey, if something's not right, something's not right. Now, that seems very simplistic, but it's actually not. Because a lot of times people will just say, well, that's just the baby. And that's just not true. So when we look at babies that pass away at 22 weeks, we don't use the excuse extreme prematurity. We try to look, what did this baby pass away from? And then fine-tune our care. So over many decades, if they were passing away from lung disease, well, we transition over many decades from conventional to high frequency. If they pass away from NEC or intestinal perforations, we work on how to minimize the risk of NEC and intestinal perforations. If they pass away from IVH, from withdrawing support, we need to have a more neuroprotective strategy. So you can't make any advancement unless you are analyzing your mortality. And in this population, you just can't do like AAP and say, well, it's extreme prematurity why they died, because we can't fix that problem. But we can reduce death from respiratory failure, death from IVH, death from sepsis.
Yeah, absolutely love it. And I love how you've described neonatology as really being a team sport. I mean, that's what you've laid out here, is we've got to all work together, everybody, to make sure that these babies get the best care possible. And just like NASA, try hard and try not to fail, but we know along the way, unfortunately, those failures will come. So, John, I really appreciate you taking time to be with us today. Just a reminder to all of our listeners that if you want to listen to more about TIPQC's Tiniest Babies Project, and specifically about our chronic lung disease reduction bundle, you can listen to our discussion with Dr. Rupali Bapat from Nationwide Children's on episode 75, CHOPS, Dr. Kate Gibbs in episode 120, and then episode 121 is a detailed discussion of this bundle of care and the toolkit with all of our state project leaders. So thanks again for tuning into another episode of Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby, Tennessee.
you for listening to this episode of Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, presented by TIPQC. TIPQC is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health. Do you have ideas for a future guest or topic, or even have a question you would like answered on upcoming episodes? Visit www.tipqc.org, that's TIPQC.org, and click on podcast to submit suggestions and questions to our podcast team. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast to be the first to know when new episodes are available, and find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube to stay in the loop with our active projects and other relevant news relating to perinatal health in Tennessee.